and a small wood-barred window. It seemed as if the sun had come out. The heavy silver glowed, and Aelwald just stared at it. "There are good priests. Beoka is one, and Willibald another. But I have discovered in my long life that most churchmen preach the merits of poverty while they lust after wealth. They love money. And the church attracts money like a candle brings moths. I knew Aelwald was a greedy man, as greedy for wealth as he was for the delights of a red-haired whore in Sippenham, and he could not take his eyes from that plate. He reached out and caressed the thick rim as if he scarce believed what he was seeing, and then he pulled the plate towards him and examined the 12 apostles. "A pyx," he said reverently. "A plate," I said casually. One of the other priests leaned over a clerk's shoulder.
"Irish work," he said.
"It looks Irish," Aelwald agreed, then looked suspiciously at me. "You are returning it to the church?"
"Returning it?"
I asked innocently. "Well, the plate was plainly stolen," Aelwald said. "And you do well, Uhtred, to bring it back."
"I had the plate made for you," I said.
He turned the plate over, which took some effort, for it was heavy, and once it was inverted, he pointed to the scratches in the silver. "It is old," he said.
"I had it made in Ireland," I said grandly,
"and doubtless it was handled roughly by the men who brought it across the sea." He knew I was lying. I did not care.
"There are silversmiths in Wessex who could have made you a pyx," one of the priests snapped.
"Well, I thought you might want it," I said, then leaned forward and pulled the plate out of the bishop's hands. "But if you prefer West Saxon work," I went on, "then I can..." "Give it back," Aelwald said. And when I made no move to obey, his voice became pleading. "It is a beautiful thing." He could see it in his church, or perhaps in his hall, and he wanted it. There was silence as he stared at it. If he had known that the plate existed, if I had told Mildreth of it, then he would have had a response ready. But as it was, he was overwhelmed by desire for the heavy silver. A maid brought in a flagon, and he waved her out of the room. She was, I noted, red-haired. "You had the plate made," Aylward said sceptically.
"In Difflin," I said.
"Is that where you went in the king's ship?"
the priest who had snapped at me asked. "We patrolled the coast," I said. "Nothing more." "The value of the plate," Aelwald began, then stopped.
"Is far and above the debt Mildreth inherited," I said.
That was probably not true, but it was close to the amount, and I could see Aelwald did not care. I was going to get what I wanted. The debt was discharged. I insisted on having that written down, and written 3 times, and I surprised them by being able to read, and so discovering that the first scrap of parchment made no mention of the church yielding their rights to the future produce of my estate. But that was corrected, and I let the bishop keep 1 copy while I took 2. "You will not be arraigned for debt," the bishop said, as he pressed his seal into the wax of the last copy. "But there is still the matter of Oswald's Weirguild."
"Well, I rely on your good and wise judgment, bishop," I said. And I opened the purse hanging at my waist and took out a small lump of gold, making sure he could see there was more gold inside as I placed the small lump on the plate. "Oswald was a thief."
"His family will make oaths that he was not," the priest said. "And I will bring men who will swear he was," I said.
A trial relied heavily on oaths, but both sides would bring as many liars as they could muster, and judgment usually went to the better liars, or, if both sides were equally convincing, to the side who had the sympathy of the onlookers. It was better, though, to have the sympathy of the judge. Oswald's family would have many supporters around Exoncester, but gold is much the best argument in a law court. And so it proved. To Mildred's astonishment, the debt was paid, and Oswald's family denied 200 shillings of Weargild. I did not even bother to go to the court, relying on the persuasive power of gold. And, sure enough, the bishop peremptorily dismissed the demand for Weargild, saying it was well known that Oswald had been a thief. And so I won. That did not make me any more popular. To the folk who lived in the Usk's Valley, I was a Northumbrian interloper, and worse, it was known I was a pagan. But none dared confront me, for I went nowhere beyond the estate without my men, and my men went nowhere without their swords. The harvest was in the storehouses. Now was the time for the Danes to come, when they could be sure to find food for their armies. But neither Guthrum nor Svein crossed the frontier. The winter came instead, and we slaughtered the livestock, salted the meat, scraped hides and made calves' foot jelly. I listened for the sound of church bells ringing at an unusual time, for that would have been a sign that the Danes had attacked. But the bells did not ring. Mildred prayed that the peace would continue, and I, being young and bored, prayed it would not. She prayed to the Christian God, and I took Iseult to the high woods and made a sacrifice to Hodder, Odin, and Thor, and the gods were listening. For in the dark, beneath the gallows tree, where the three spinners make our lives, a red thread was woven into my life. Fate is everything. And just after Yule, the spinners brought a royal messenger to Oxton, and he, in turn, brought me a summons. It seemed possible that Iseult's dream was true, and that Alfred would give me power, for I was ordered to Sippenham to see the king. I was summoned to the Witan.
Chapter 5
Mildred was excited by the summons. The Witan gave the king advice, and her father had never been wealthy or important enough to receive such a summons, and she was overjoyed that the king wanted my presence. The Witangamot, as the meeting was called, was always held on the feast of St. Stephen, the day after Christmas, but my summons required me to be there on the 12th day of Christmas, and that gave Mildred time to wash clothes for me. They had to be boiled and scrubbed and dried and brushed, and three women did the work, and it took 3 days before Mildred was satisfied that I would not disgrace her by appearing at Sippenham looking like a vagabond. She was not summoned, nor did she expect to accompany me, but she made a point of telling all our neighbours that I was to give counsel to the king.
"You mustn't wear that,"
she told me, pointing to my Thor's hammer amulet.
"I always wear it," I said. "Then hide it,"
she said.
"And don't be belligerent."
"Belligerent?"
"Listen to what others say,"
she said.
"Be humble. And remember to congratulate Otto the Younger."
"For what?"
"He's to be married. Tell him I pray for them both."
She was happy again. Sure that by paying the church its debt I had regained Alfred's favour, and her good mood was not even spoilt when I announced I would take Iseult with me. She bridled slightly at the news, then said that it was only right that Iseult should be taken to Alfred.
"If she is a queen,"
Mildred said,
"then she belongs in Alfred's court. This isn't a fit place for her."
She insisted on taking silver coins to the church in Exoncester, where she donated the money to the poor, and gave thanks that I had been restored to Alfred's favour. She also thanked God for the good health of our son, Uhtred. I saw little of him, for he was still a baby, and I've never had much patience for babies, but the women of Oxton constantly assured me that he was a lusty, strong boy. We allowed 2 days for the journey. I took Hasten and 6 men as an escort, for though the Shire Reeve's men patrolled the roads, there were plenty of wild places where outlaws preyed on travellers. We were in mail coats or leather tunics, with swords, spears, axes and shields. We all rode. Isolt had a small black mare I had bought for her, and I'd also given her an otterskin cloak, and when we passed through villages, folk would stare at her, for she rode like a man, her black hair bound up with a silver chain. They would kneel to her, as well as to me, and call out for alms. She did not take her maid, for I remembered how crowded every tavern and house had been in Exoncester when the Witan met, and I persuaded Isolt that we would be hard-pressed to find accommodation for ourselves, let alone a maid.
"What does the king want of you?"
she asked as we rode up the Usk Valley. Rainwater puddled in the long furrows, gleaming in the winter sunshine, while the woods were glossy with holly leaves and bright with the berries of rowan, thorn, elder and yew. "Well, aren't you supposed to tell me that?" I asked her. She smiled.
"Seeing the future," she said, "is like travelling a strange road. Usually you cannot see far ahead, and when you can it is only a glimpse. And my brother doesn't give me dreams about everything."
"Mildred thinks the king has forgiven me," I said.
"Has he?"
I shrugged. "Perhaps. I hope so. Not because I wanted Alfred's forgiveness, but because I wanted to be given command of the fleet again. I wanted to be with Leofric. I wanted the wind in my face and the sea rain on my cheek." "It's odd, though," I went on, "that he didn't want me there for the whole Witangamot."
"Maybe,"
Isolt suggested,
"they discussed religious things at first."
"Well, he wouldn't want me there for that," I said.
"So that's it,"
she said.
"They talk about their god, but at the end they will talk of the Danes, and that is why he summoned you. He knows he needs you."
"Well, perhaps he just wants me there for the feast," I suggested.
"The feast?"
"The 12th night feast," I explained. And that seemed to me the likeliest explanation. That Alfred had decided to forgive me, and, to show he now approved of me, would let me attend the winter feast. I secretly hoped that was true. And it was a strange hope. I had been ready to kill Alfred only a few months before, yet now, though I still hated him, I wanted his approval. Such is ambition. If I could not rise with Ragnar, then I would make my reputation with Alfred.
"Your road, Uhtred,"
Isolt went on,
"is like a bright blade across a dark moor. I see it clearly."
"And the Woman of Gold?" She said nothing to that. "Is it you?" I asked.
"The sun dimmed when I was born," she said, "so I am a woman of darkness and of silver, not of gold."
"So who is she?"
"Someone far away, Uhtred. Far away."
And she'd say no more. Perhaps she knew no more. Or perhaps she was guessing. We reached Sippenham late on the 11th day of Yule. There was still frost on the furrows, and the sun was a gross red ball poised low above the tangling black branches as we came to the town's western gate. The city was full, but I was known in the Corncrake Tavern, where the red-headed whore called Ainflaid worked, and she found a shelter in a half-collapsed cattle byre where a score of hounds had been kennelled. The hounds, she said, belonged to Hupper, Elderman of Thornseater, but she reckoned the animals could survive a night or two in the yard.
"Hupper may not think so,"
she said,
"but he can rot in hell."
"He doesn't pay," I asked her. She spat for answer, then looked at me curiously.
"I hear Leofric's here."
"He is," I said, heartened by the news.
"I haven't seen him,"
she said,
"but someone said he was here, in the Royal Hall. Maybe Berkweird brought him."
Berkweird was the new fleet commander, the one who wanted his ships to sail two by two in imitation of Christ's disciples.
Leofric had better not be here,
Eanfleid finished.
Why not?
Because he hasn't come to see me, she said indignantly. That's why.
She was 5 or 6 years older than I, with a broad face, a high forehead, and springy hair. She was popular, so much so that she had a good deal of freedom in the tavern, that owed its profits more to her abilities than to the quality of the ale. I knew she was friendly with Leofric, but I suspected from her tone that she wanted to be more than friends.
Who's she?
She asked, jerking her head at Isolde. A queen, I said.
That's another name for it, I suppose. How's your wife?
Back in Devonshire.
You're like all the rest, aren't you?
She shivered.
If you're cold tonight, bring the hounds back in to warm you. I'm off to work.
We were cold, but I slept well enough. And next morning, the 12th after Christmas, I left my 6 men at the Corncrake and took Isolde and Hasten to the king's buildings that lay behind their own palisade to the south of the town, where the river curled about the walls. A man expected to attend the Wittingamot with retainers, though not usually with a Dane and a Briton. But Isolde wanted to see Alfred, and I wanted to please her. Besides, there was the great feast that evening, and though I warned her that Alfred's feasts were poor things, Isolde still wanted to be there. Hasten, with his mail coat and sword, was there to protect her, for I suspected she might not be allowed into the hall while the Wittingamot debated, and so might have to wait until evening for her chance to glimpse Alfred. The gatekeeper demanded that we surrender our weapons, a thing I did with a bad grace. But no man, except the king's own household troops, could go armed in Alfred's presence. The day's talking had already begun, the gatekeeper told us, and so we hurried past the stables and past the big new royal chapel with its twin towers. A group of priests was huddled by the main door of the great hall, and I recognized Beocca, my father's old priest, among them. I smiled in greeting, but his face, as he came towards us, was drawn and pale.
"You're late," he said sharply.
"Are you not pleased to see me?" I asked sarcastically. He looked up at me. Beocca, despite his squint, red hair and palsied left hand, had grown into a stern authority. He was now a royal chaplain, confessor and confidant to the king, and his responsibilities had carved deep lines on his face.
"I prayed," he said, "never to see this day."
He made the sign of the cross.
"Who's that?"
He stared at Isolde. "A queen of the Britons," I said.
"She's what?"
"A queen. She's with me. She wants to see Alfred." I don't know whether he believed me, but he seemed not to care. Instead he was distracted, worried, and because he lived in a strange world of kingly privilege and obsessive piety, I assumed his misery had been caused by some petty theological dispute. He had been Bebbanburg's mass priest when I was a child, and, after my father's death, he had fled Northumberland because he could not abide living among the pagan Danes. He had found refuge in Alfred's court, where he had become a friend of the king. He was also a friend to me, a man who had preserved the parchments that proved my claim to the lordship of Bebbanburg. But on that 12th day of Yule, he was anything but pleased to see me. He plucked my arm, drawing me towards the door.
"We must go in," he said, "and may God in his mercy protect you."
"Protect me?"
"God is merciful," Beocca said, "and you must pray for that mercy."
And then the guards opened the door and we walked into the great hall. No one stopped Isolde, and indeed there were a score of other women watching the proceedings from the edge of the hall. There were also more than 100 men there, though only 40 or 50 comprised the Wittingamot, and those thanes and senior churchmen were on chairs and benches, set in a half-circle in front of a dais where Alfred sat with 2 priests, and with Aelswith, his wife, who was pregnant. Behind them, draped with a red cloth, was an altar, on which stood thick candles and a heavy silver cross, while all about the walls were platforms, where in normal times folk slept or ate, to be out of the fierce draughts. This day, though, the platforms were crammed with the followers of the thanes and noblemen of the Witan, and among them, of course, were a lot of priests and monks, for Alfred's court was more like a monastery than a royal hall. Bjorka gestured that Isolt and Hasten should join those spectators. Then he drew me towards the half-circle of privileged advisers. No one noticed my arrival. It was dark in the hall, for little of the wintry sunshine penetrated the small, high windows. Braziers tried to give some warmth, but failed, succeeding only in thickening the smoke in the high rafters. There was a large central hearth, but the fire had been taken away to make room for the Witangamot's circle of stools, chairs, and benches. A tall man, in a blue cloak, was on his feet as I approached. He was talking of the necessity of repairing bridges, and how local thanes were skimping the duty, and he suggested that the king appoint an official to survey the kingdom's roads. Another man interrupted to complain that such an appointment would encroach on the privileges of the shire eldermen, and that started a chorus of voices, some for the proposal, most against. And two priests, seated at a small table beside Alfred's dais, tried to write down all the comments. I recognised Wulfhere, the ealdorman of Wiltonshire, who yawned prodigiously. Close to him was Aelwald, the bishop of Exoncester, who was swathed in furs. Still no one noticed me. Bjorka had held me back as if waiting for a lull in the proceedings before finding me a seat. Two servants brought in baskets of logs to feed the braziers, and it was then that Aelswith saw me, and she leaned across and whispered in Alfred's ear. He had been paying close attention to the discussion, but now looked past his counsel to stare at me. And a silence fell on that great hall. There had been a murmur of voices when men saw the king being distracted from the argument about bridges, and they'd all turned to look at me. And then there was the silence that was broken by a priest's sneeze, and a sudden odd scramble as the men closest to me, those sitting beside the cold stones of the hearth, moved to one side. They were not making way for me, but avoiding me. Aelswith was smiling, and I knew I was in trouble then. My hand instinctively went to my left side, but of course I had no sword, so could not touch her hilt for luck.
"We shall talk of bridges later," Alfred said.
He stood. He wore a bronze circlet as a crown and had a fur-trimmed blue robe, matching the gown worn by his wife.
"What's happening?" I asked Bjorka.
"You will be silent."
It was Odda the Younger who spoke. He was dressed in his war glory, in shining mail covered by a black cloak, in high boots and with a red leather sword belt from which hung his weapons, for Odda, as commander of the king's troops, was permitted to go armed in the royal hall. I looked into his eyes and saw triumph there, the same triumph that was on the Lady Aelswith's pinched face, and I knew I had not been brought to receive the king's favour, but summoned to face my enemies. I was right. A priest was called from the dark gaggle beside the door. He was a young man with a pouchy, scowling face. He moved briskly, as if the day did not have enough hours to complete his work. He bowed to the king, then took a parchment from the table where the two clerks sat, and came to stand in the centre of the Witan circle.
"There is an urgent matter," Alfred said, "which, with the Witan's permission, we shall deal with now."
No one there was likely to disagree, so a low murmur offered approval of interrupting the more mundane discussions. Alfred nodded.
"Father Erkenwald will read the charges,"
the king said, and took his throne again. Charges? I was confused, like a boar trapped between hounds and spears, and I seemed incapable of movement, so I just stood there, as Father Erkenwald unrolled the parchment and cleared his throat.
"Uhtred of Oxton,"
he said, speaking in a high and precise voice.
You are this day charged with the crime of taking a king's ship without our king's consent, and with taking that ship to the country of Cornwallum, and there making war against the Britons, again without our king's consent. And this we can prove by oaths.
There was a small murmur in the hall, a murmur that was stilled when Alfred raised a thin hand.
You are further charged,
Birkenwald went on,
with making an alliance with the pagan called Svein, and with his help you murdered Christian folk in Cornwallum, despite those folk living in peace with our king. And this also we can prove by oaths.
He paused, and now there was complete silence in the hall.
And you are charged?
Erkenwald's voice was lower now, as though he could scarce believe what he was reading.
With joining the pagan Svein in an attack on our blessed king's realm by committing vile murder and impious church robbery at Sinuit.
This time there was no murmur, but a loud outburst of indignation, and Alfred made no move to check it, so Erkenwald had to raise his voice to finish the indictment.
And this also,
he was shouting now, and men hushed to listen.
We shall prove by oaths.
He lowered the parchment, gave me a look of pure loathing, then walked back to the edge of the dais.
Oh, he's lying, I snarled. You will have a chance to speak,
a fierce-looking churchman sitting beside Alfred said. He was in monk's robes, but over them he wore a priest's half-cape, richly embroidered with crosses. He had a full head of white hair and a deep, stern voice.
Who's that?
I asked Bjorka.
The Most Holy Ethelred,
Bjorka said softly, and, seeing I did not recognize the name,
Archbishop of Contwerberg, of course.
The Archbishop leaned over to speak with Erkenwald. Aelswith was staring at me. She'd never liked me, and now she was watching my destruction and taking a great pleasure from it. Alfred, meanwhile, was studying the roof beams, as though he had never noticed them before, and I realized he intended to take no part in this trial. For trial it was. He would let other men prove my guilt, but doubtless he would pronounce sentence, and not just on me, it seemed, because the Archbishop scowled,
"Is the second prisoner here?"
"He is held in the stables,"
Odd the Younger said.
"He should be here,"
the Archbishop said indignantly.
"A man has a right to hear his accusers." "What other man?"
I demanded. It was Leofric, who was brought into the hall in chains, and there was no outcry against him because men perceived him as my follower. The crime was mine. Leofric had been snared by it, and now he would suffer for it, but he plainly had the sympathy of the men in the hall as he was brought to stand beside me. They knew him. He was of Wessex, while I was a Northumbrian interloper. He gave me a rueful glance as the guards led him to my side.
"Up to our arses, innit?" he muttered.
"Quiet!"
Bjorka hissed.
"Trust me," I said.
"Trust you?"
Leofric asked bitterly. But I glanced at Isolt, and she had given me the smallest shake of her head, an indication, I reckon, that she had seen the outcome of this day, and it was good.
"Trust me," I said again.
"The prisoners will be silent,"
the Archbishop said.
"Up to our royal arses,"
Leofric said quietly. The Archbishop gestured at Father Erkenwald.
"Do you have oath-makers?"
he asked.
"I do, Lord."
"Then let us hear the first."
Erkenwald gestured to another priest who was standing by the door leading to the passage at the back of the hall. The door was opened, and a slight figure in a dark cloak entered. I could not see his face, for he wore a hood. He hurried to the front of the dais and there bowed low to the king and went on his knees to the Archbishop, who held out a hand so that his heavy jeweled ring could be kissed. Only then did the man stand, push back his hood, and turn to face me. It was the ass,
Asser, the Welsh monk. He stared at me as yet another priest brought him a gospel book on which he laid a thin hand.
"I make oath,"
he said in accented English, still staring at me,
"that what I say is truth, and God so help me in that endeavour, and condemn me to the eternal fires of hell if I dissemble."
He bent and kissed the gospel book with the tenderness of a man caressing a lover. "Bastard," I muttered. Asser was a good oath-maker. He spoke clearly, describing how I had come to Cornwallum in a ship that bore a beast head on its prow and another on its stern. He told how I had agreed to help King Peridor, who was being attacked by a neighbour assisted by the pagan Svein, and how I had betrayed Peridor by allying myself with the Dane.
"Together,"
Asser said,
"they made great slaughter, and I myself saw a holy priest put to death."
"You ran like a chicken," I said to him. "You couldn't see a thing."
Asser turned to the king and bowed.
"I did run, Lord King. I am a brother monk, not a warrior, and when Uhtred turned that hillside red with Christian blood, I did take flight. I'm not proud of that, Lord King, and I have earnestly sought God's forgiveness for my cowardice."
Alfred smiled, and the Archbishop waved away Asser's remarks as if they were nothing.
"And when you left the slaughter," Erkenwald asked, "what then?"
"I watched from a hilltop," Asser said, "and I saw Uhtred of Oxton leave that place in the company of the pagan ship. Two ships sailing westwards."
"They sailed westwards?" Erkenwald asked.
"To the west,"
Asser confirmed. Erkenwald glanced at me. There was silence in the hall as men leaned forward to catch each damning word.
"And what lay to the west?"
Erkenwald asked.
"I cannot say," Asser said. "But if they did not go to the end of the world, then I assume they turned about Cornwallum to go into the Savan Sea."
"And you know no more?"
Erkenwald asked.
"I know I helped bury the dead,"
Asser said,
"and I said prayers for their souls, and I saw the smouldering embers of the burned church. But what Uhtred did when he left the place of slaughter, I do not know. I only know he went westwards."
Alfred was pointedly taking no part in the proceedings. But he plainly liked Asser, for when the Welshman's testimony was done, he beckoned him to the dais and rewarded him with a coin and a moment of private conversation. The Witan talked among themselves, sometimes glancing at me with the curiosity we give to doomed men. The Lady Elswith, suddenly so gracious, smiled on Asser.
"You have anything to say?"
Erkenwald demanded of me when Asser had been dismissed. "I shall wait," I said, "till all your lies are told." The truth, of course, was that Asser had told the truth, and told it plainly, clearly, and persuasively. The king's counsellors had been impressed, just as they were impressed by Erkenwald's second oath-maker. It was Stiapa Snotor, the warrior who was never far from Odda the Younger's side. His back was straight, his shoulders square, and his feral face with its stretched skin was grim. He glanced at me, bowed to the king, then laid a huge hand on the gospel book, and let Erkenwald lead him through the oath, and he swore to tell the truth on pain of hell's eternal agony. And then he lied. He lied calmly, in a flat, toneless voice. He said he had been in charge of the soldiers who guarded the place at Sinuit where the new church was being built, and how two ships had come in the dawn, and how the warriors streamed from the ships, and how he had fought against them and killed six of such. But there were too many, far too many, and he had been forced to retreat. But he had seen the attackers slaughter the priests, and he had heard the pagan leader shout his name as a boast.
"Svein," he was called.
"And Svein brought two ships?"
Stiapa paused and frowned as though he had trouble counting to two, then nodded.
"He had two ships."
"He led both?"
"Svein led one of the ships,"
Stiapa said. Then he pointed a finger at me. And he led the other. The audience seemed to growl, and the noise was so threatening that Alfred slapped the arm of his chair and finally stood to restore quiet. Stiapa seemed unmoved. He stood, solid as an oak, and though he had not told his tale as convincingly as Brother Asser, there was something very damning in his testimony. It was so matter-of-fact, so unemotionally told, so straightforward. And none of it was true.
Uhtred led the second ship,
Erkenwald said.
But did Uhtred join in the killing?
Join it? Stiapa asked. He led it. He snarled those words, and the men in the hall growled their anger. Erkenwald turned to the king.
Lord King,
he said,
he must die.
And his land and property must be forfeited,
Bishop Aylward shouted, in such excitement that a whirl of his spittle landed and hissed in the nearest brazier.
Forfeited to the church!
The men in the hall thumped their feet on the ground to show their approbation. Aylesworth nodded vigorously, but the Archbishop clapped his hands for silence.
He has not spoken,
he reminded Erkenwald, then nodded at me.
Say your piece,
he ordered curtly.
Beg for mercy,
Bjorkr advised me quietly. When you're up to your arse in shit, there's only one thing to do. Attack. And so I admitted I had been at Sinuit, and that admission provoked some gasps in the hall. But I was not there last summer, I went on. I was there in the spring, at which time I killed Uber Lothbrookson. And there are men in this hall who saw me do it. Yet Odda the Younger claimed the credit. He took Uber's banner, which I laid low, and he took it to his king, and he claimed to have killed Uber. Now, lest I spread the truth, which is that he is a coward and a liar, he would have me murdered by lies. I pointed to Stiapa.
His lies!
Stiapa spat to show his scorn. Odda the Younger was looking furious, but he said nothing, and some men noted it. To be called a coward and a liar is to be invited to do battle. But Odda stayed still as a stump.
You cannot prove what you say,
Erkenwald said.
I can prove I killed Uber,
I said.
We are not here to discuss such things,
Erkenwald said loftily,
but to determine whether you broke the king's peace by an impious attack on Sinuit.
Then summon my crewmen,
I demanded.
Bring them here. Put them on oath, and ask what they did in the summer.
I waited, and Erkenwald said nothing. He glanced at the king as if seeking help, but Alfred's eyes were momentarily closed.
Or are you in so much of a hurry to kill me,
I went on,
that you dare not wait to hear the truth?
I have Stiapa's sworn testimony,
Erkenwald said, as if that made any other evidence unnecessary. He was flustered.
And you can have my oath,
I said,
and Leofric's oath, and the oath of a crewman who is here.
I turned and beckoned Haston, who looked frightened at being summoned, but at Isolt's urging came to stand beside me.
Put him on oath,
I demanded of Erkenwald. Erkenwald did not know what to do, but some men in the Witan called out that I had the right to summon oath-makers, and the newcomer must be heard. And so a priest brought the gospel book to Haston. I waved the priest away.
He'll swear on this,
I said, and took out Thor's amulet.
He's not a Christian,
Erkenwald demanded in astonishment.
He's a Dane,
I said.
How can we trust the word of a Dane?
Erkenwald demanded.
But our Lord King does,
I retorted.
He trusts the word of Guthrum to keep the peace. So why should this Dane not be trusted?
That provoked some smiles. Many in the Witan thought Alfred far too trusting of Guthrum, and I felt the sympathy in the hall move to my side. But then the Archbishop intervened to declare that the oath of a pagan was of no value.
None whatsoever,
he snapped.
He must stand down.
"Then put Leofric under oath," I demanded, "and then bring our crew here and listen to their testimony." "And you will all lie with one tongue," Erkenwald said. "And what happened at Sinuit is not the only matter on which you are accused. Do you deny that you sailed in the king's ship? That you went to Cornwallum and there betrayed Peridor and killed his Christian people? Do you deny that Brother Asser told the truth?"
"But what if Peridor's queen were to tell you that Asser lies?" I asked.
"What if she were to tell you that he lies like a hound at the hearth?"
Erkenwald stared at me. They all stared at me. And I turned and gestured at Isolt, who stepped forward, tall and delicate, the silver glinting at her neck and wrists.
"Peridor's queen," I announced, "whom I demand that you hear under oath, and thus hear how her husband was planning to join the Danes in an assault on Wessex."
That was rank nonsense, of course, but it was the best I could invent at that moment, and Isolt, I knew, would swear to its truth. Quite why Svein would fight Peridor if the Briton planned to support him was a dangerously loose plank in the argument, but it did not really matter, for I had confused the proceedings so much that no one was sure what to do. Erkenwald was speechless. Men stood to look at Isolt, who looked calmly back at them, and the king and the archbishop bent their heads together. Aelswith, one hand clapped to her pregnant belly, hissed advice at them. None of them wanted to summon Isolt, for fear of what she would say, and Alfred, I suspect, knew that the trial, which had already become mired in lies, could only get worse.
"You're good, Eirsling," Leofric muttered. "You're very good."
Otto the Younger looked at the king, then at his fellow members of the Witan, and he must have known I was slithering out of his snare, for he pulled Stiapa to his side. He spoke to him urgently. The king was frowning. The archbishop looked perplexed. Aelswith's blotched face showed fury, while Erkenwald seemed helpless. Then Stiapa rescued them.
"I do not lie!" he shouted.
He seemed uncertain what to say next, but he had the hall's attention. The king gestured to him, as if inviting him to continue, and Otto the Younger whispered in the big man's ear.
"He says I lie,"
Stiapa said, pointing at me.
"And I say I do not. And my sword says I do not."
He stopped abruptly, having made what was probably the longest speech of his life. But it was enough. Feet drummed on the floor and men shouted that Stiapa was right, which he was not, but he had reduced the whole tangled morass of lies and accusations to a trial by combat, and they all liked that. The archbishop still looked troubled, but Alfred gestured for silence. He looked at me.
"Well?"
he asked. "Stiapa says his sword will support his truth. Does yours?" I could have said no. I could have insisted on letting Isolt speak, and then allowing the Witan to advise the king which side had spoken the greater truth. But I was ever rash, ever impetuous, and the invitation to fight cut through the whole entanglement. If I fought and won, then Leofric and I were innocent of every charge. I did not even think about losing. I just looked at Stiapa. "My sword," I told him, "says I tell the truth, and that you are a stinking bag of wind, a liar from hell, a cheat and a perjurer who deserves death."
"Up to our arses again," Leofric said.
Men cheered. They liked to fight to the death, and it was much better entertainment than listening to Alfred's harpist chant the psalms. Alfred hesitated, and I saw Aelswith look from me to Stiapa. And she must have thought him the greater warrior, for she leaned forward, touched Alfred's elbow, and whispered urgently. And the king nodded.
"Granted,"
he said. He sounded weary, as if he was dispirited by the lies and the insults.
"You will fight tomorrow. Swords and shields, nothing else."
He held up a hand to stop the cheering.
"My lord, Wulfhere."
"Sire."
Wulfhere struggled to his feet.
You will arrange the fight, and may God grant victory to the truth.
Alfred stood, pulled his robe about him, and left. And Stiapa, for the first time since I had seen him, smiled.
"You're a damn fool," Leofric told me. He had been released from his chains and allowed to spend the evening with me. Hasten was there, as was Isolt and my men who had been brought from the town. We were lodged in the king's compound in a cattle byre that stank of dung, but I did not notice the smell. It was Twelfth Night, so there was the great feast in the king's hall, but we were left out in the cold, watched there by two of the royal guards.
"Stiapa's good," Leofric warned me.
"I'm good."
"He's better," Leofric said bluntly. "He'll slaughter you."
"He won't,"
Isolt said calmly.
"Damn it, he's good,"
Leofric insisted. And I believed him.
"What is that goddamn monk's fault?" I said bitterly.
"He went bleating to Alfred, didn't he?" In truth, Asa had been sent by the king of Difford to assure the West Saxons that Difford was not planning war. But Asa had taken the opportunity of his embassy to recount the tale of the Eftweird, and from that it was a small jump to conclude that we had stayed with Svein while he attacked Sinuit. Alfred had no proof of our guilt, but Odda the Younger had seen a chance to destroy me, and so persuaded Stiapa to lie.
"Now Stiapa will kill you," Leofric grumbled. "Whatever she says."
Isolt did not bother to answer him. She was using handfuls of grubby straw to clean my mail coat. The armour had been fetched from the Corncrake Tavern and given to me, but I would have to wait till morning to get my weapons, which meant they would not be newly sharpened. Stiapa, because he served Odda the Younger, was one of the king's bodyguard, so he would have all night to put an edge on his sword. The royal kitchens had sent us food, though I had no appetite.
"Just take it slow in the morning," Leofric told me. "Slow. You fight in a rage," he said, "and Stiapa's always calm."
"So better to fight in a rage," I said.
"Well, that's what he wants. He'll fend you off, and fend you off, and wait till you're tired. Then he'll finish you off. It's how he fights."
Harald told us the same thing. Harald was the Shire Reeve of Devonshire, the widower who had summoned me to the court in Exoncester. But he had also fought alongside us at Sinuit, and that makes a bond. And sometime, in the dark, he splashed through the rain and mud and came into the light of the small fire that lit the cattle shed without warming it. He stopped in the doorway and gazed at me reproachfully.
"Were you with Svein at Sinuit?"
he asked.
"No,"
I said.
"I didn't think so."
Harald came into the byre and sat by the fire. The two royal guards were at the door, and he ignored them, and that was interesting. All of them served Odda, and the young elderman would not be pleased to hear that Harald had come to us. Yet plainly Harald trusted the two guards not to tell, which suggested that there was unhappiness in Odda's ranks. Harald put a pot of ale on the floor.
"Stiapa's sitting at the king's table," he said.
"So is eating badly," I said. Harald nodded, but did not smile.
"Well, it's not much of a feast," he admitted.
He stared into the fire for a moment, then looked at me.
"How's Mildreth?"
"Well,
she is a dear girl," he said,
then glanced at Isolt's dark beauty before staring into the fire again.
"There will be a church service at dawn," he said, "and after that you and Stiapa will fight."
"Where?"
"In a field on the other side of the river," he said, then pushed the pot of ale towards me. "He's left-handed."
I could not remember fighting against a man who held his sword in his left hand, but nor could I see a disadvantage in it. We would both have our shields facing the other man's shield instead of his weapon, but that would be a problem to both of us. I shrugged.
"He's used to it,"
Harald explained. And you're not. And he wears mail down to here. He touched his calf. And he has an iron strip on his left boot. Well, because that's his vulnerable foot. He plants it forward, Harald said, inviting attack. Then chops at your sword arm. So he's a hard man to kill, I said mildly. No one's done it yet, Harald said gloomily. You don't like him? He did not answer at first, but drank ale, then passed the pot to Leofric. I like the old man, he said, meaning Odder the Elder. He's foul-tempered, but he's fair enough. But the son... He shook his head sadly. I think the son is untested. Stiapa, well, I don't dislike him, but he's like a hound. He only knows how to kill. I stared into the feeble fire, looking for a sign from the gods in the small flames, but none came, or none that I saw. We must be worried, though, Leofric said. Stiapa? Harald asked. Why should he be worried? Uhtred killed Uber. Harald shook his head. Stiapa doesn't think enough to be worried. He just knows he'll kill Uhtred tomorrow. I thought back to the fight with Uber. He had been a great warrior, with a reputation that glowed wherever Norsemen sailed, and I had killed him. But the truth was that he had put a foot into the spilled guts of a dying man and slipped. His leg had shot sideways, he'd lost his balance, and I'd managed to cut the tendons in his arm. I touched the hammer amulet and thought that the gods had sent me a sign after all. An iron strip in his boot, I asked. Harald nodded. He doesn't care how much you attack him. He knows you're coming from his left, and he'll block most of your attacks with his sword. Big sword, heavy thing. But some blows will get by, and he won't care. You'll waste them on iron. Heavy mail, helmet, boot, doesn't matter. It'll be like hitting an oak tree, and after a while you'll make a mistake. He'll be bruised, and you'll be dead. He was right, I thought. Striking an armored man with a sword rarely achieved much except to make a bruise, because the edge would be stopped by mail or helmet. Mail cannot be chopped open by a sword, which was why so many men carried axes into battle. But the rules of trial by combat said the fight had to be with swords. A sword lunge would pierce mail, but Stiapa was not going to make himself an easy target for a lunge. Is he quick? I asked. Quick enough, Harald said, then shrugged. Not as quick as you, he said grudgingly. But he isn't slow. What does the money say? Leofric asked, though he surely knew the answer. No one's wagering a penny on Uhtred, Harald said. You should, I retorted. He smiled at that, but I knew he would not take the advice. The big money, he said, is what Odder will give Stiapa when he kills you. 100 shillings. Uhtred's not worth it, Leofric said with rough humour. Why does he want me dead so badly? I wondered out loud. It could not be Mildrith, I thought, and the argument over who had killed Uber was long in the past, yet still Odder the Younger conspired against me. Harald paused a long time before answering. He had his bald head bowed, and I thought he was in prayer, but then he looked up. You threaten him, he said quietly. I haven't even seen him for months, I protested, so how do I threaten him? Harald paused again, choosing his words carefully. The king is frequently ill, he said after the pause. And who can say how long he will live? And if, God forbid, he should die soon, then the Witan will not choose his infant son to be the king. They'll choose a nobleman with a reputation made on the battlefield. They'll choose a man who can stand up to the Danes. Odder? I laughed at the thought of Odder as king. Who else? Harald asked. But if you were to stand before the Witan and swear an oath to the truth about the battle where Uber died, they might not choose him. So, you threaten him, and he fears you because of that.
So now he's paying Stiapa to chop you to bits, Leofric added gloomily. Harald left. He was a decent man, honest and hard-working, and he'd taken a risk by coming to see me, and I had been poor company, for I did not appreciate the gesture he made. It was plain he thought I must die in the morning, and he'd done his best to prepare me for the fight. But despite Isolt's confident prediction that I would live, I did not sleep well. I was worried, and it was cold. The rain turned to sleet in the night, and the wind whipped into the byre. By dawn, the wind and sleet had stopped, and instead there was a mist shrouding the buildings, and icy water dripping from the mossy thatch. I made a poor breakfast of damp bread, and it was while I was eating that Father Bjorka came and said Alfred wished to speak with me. I was sour. "What do you mean he wants to pray with me?"
"He wants to speak with you," Bjorka insisted,
and when I did not move, he stamped his lame foot.
"It is not a request, Uhtred. It is a royal order."
I put on my mail, not because it was time to arm for the fight, but because its leather lining offered some warmth on a cold morning. The mail was not very clean, despite Isolt's efforts. Most men wore their hair short, but I liked the Danish way of leaving it long, and so I tied it behind with a lace, and Isolt plucked the straw scraps from it.
"We must hurry," Bjorka said.
And I followed him through the muds, past the great hall and the newly built church, to some smaller buildings made of timber that had still not weathered grey. Alfred's father had used Sippenham as a hunting lodge, but Alfred was expanding it. The church had been his first new building, and he had built that even before he repaired and extended the palisade, and that was an indication of his priorities. Even now, when the nobility of Wessex was gathered just a day's march from the Danes, there seemed to be more churchmen than soldiers in the place, and that was another indication of how Alfred thought to protect his realm.
"The king is gracious," Bjorka
hissed at me as we went through the door.
"So be humble."
Bjorka knocked on another door, did not wait for an answer, but pushed it open and indicated I should step inside. He did not follow me, but closed the door, leaving me in a gloomy half-darkness. A pair of beeswax candles flickered on an altar, and by their light I saw two men kneeling in front of the plain wooden cross that stood between the candles. The men had their backs to me, but I recognized Alfred by his fur-trimmed blue cloak. The second man was a monk. They were both praying silently, and I waited. The room was small, evidently a private chapel, and its only furniture was the draped altar and a kneeling stool, on which was a closed book.
"In the name of the Father," Alfred broke the silence.
"And of the Son,"
the monk said, and he spoke English with an accent, and I recognized the voice of the Ass.
"And of the Holy Ghost," Alfred concluded. "Amen."
"Amen,"
Asa echoed. And both men stood, their faces suffused with the joy of devout Christians who have said their prayers well, and Alfred blinked as though he were surprised to see me, though he must have heard Bjorka's knocking and the sound of the door opening and closing.
"I trust you slept well, Uhtred,"
he said. "I trust you did, Lord."
"The pains kept me awake,"
Alfred said, touching his belly. Then he went to one side of the room and hauled open a big pair of wooden shutters, flooding the chapel with a wan, misty light. The window looked onto a courtyard, and I was aware of men out there. The king shivered, for it was freezing in the chapel.
"It is St. Sed's feast day,"
he told me. I said nothing.
"You have heard of St. Sed?"
he asked me. And when my silence betrayed ignorance, he smiled indulgently.
"He was an East Anglian. Am I not right, brother?"
"The Most Blessed Sed was indeed an East Angle lord,"
Asa confirmed.
"And his mission was in Lundeen,"
Alfred went on.
"But he concluded his days at Lindisfarne. You must know that house, Uhtred."
I know it, Lord, I said. The island was a short ride from Bebbanburg, and not so long before I had ridden to its monastery with Earl Ragnar and watched the monks die beneath Danish swords. I know it well, I added.